From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, impasse over Ukraine. Diplomatic efforts see little progress as John Kerry and his Russian counterpart meet in London ahead of Crimea's vote to join Russia.
President Putin is not prepared to make any decision regarding Ukraine until after the referendum on Sunday.
Plus, President Obama's major shake-up of his deportation policies after weeks of pressure from Democrats and immigrant communities. And we look back at the life of iconic British left-wing politician and campaigner, Tony Benn.
I fear that the United States has already decided that when it is ready, it will create a pretext for a war against Iran.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Russia and the U.S. have reached no common vision on the Ukraine at crisis talks in London. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov have agreed to keep in touch, with the U.S. expressing deep concern about Russian troop movements on Ukraine's eastern border. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
After 6 hours of talks with Sergei Lavrov, John Kerry said the US is making every effort to de-escalate the situation ahead of Crimea's referendum.
I presented a number of ideas on behalf of the president, which we believe absolutely could provide a path forward. However, after much discussion, the foreign minister made it clear that President Putin is not prepared to make any decision regarding Ukraine until after the referendum on Sunday.
Sergei Lavrov insisted Russia has no plans to invade eastern Ukraine, but that it will respect the will of the Crimean people.
The heads of Russia's two biggest companies, natural gas monopoly Gazprom and oil giant Rosneft, could be hit by sanctions imposed by Europe and the U.S. on Monday. The EU is looking at freezing the assets of around 130 Russians in response to the referendum to take place in Crimea on Sunday. This comes amid increasing concerns that Russia could send troops to East Ukraine, as our correspondent Natalie Feary reports from Moscow.
A spokesperson for Russia's biggest oil company, Rosneft, said sanctions aimed at the CEO of the company would have a major impact on its business partners in the West. Many parts of Europe are reliant on oil from Russia. The planned sanctions aimed at Russia's elite are seen as an attempt to dissuade them from backing Putin's stance on Crimea. This comes as Russia builds up its troops along the border with Ukraine. Concerns are mounting among members of the international community about the possibility of Russia sending troops to parts of East Ukraine, where pro-Russian and pro-Ukrainian rallies have resulted in violent clashes.
The U.S. has sent surveillance teams to the Indian Ocean to look for the missing Malaysian passenger jet that disappeared on Saturday with 239 people on board. The move comes after investigators revealed the plane may have flown for several hours longer than initially thought. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Unnamed U.S. officials said the plane sent signals to satellites for up to 5 hours after it disappeared. Investigators are adamant, though, there's still not enough information and that the fresh revelations are inconclusive. Flight MH370 vanished en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing and last made contact with air traffic control over the South China Sea to the east of Malaysia.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. American car giant General Motors is under increased pressure. New analysis by a private watchdog group found that 303 deaths may have been caused by faulty ignition switches in now-recalled GM cars, a much higher number than previously reported. As the New York Times reports, the Center for Auto Safety is criticizing the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration for failing to detect this trend of crashes in GM cars. Priscilla Huff reports from Washington.
303 people died in crashes when the ignition switches cut off in General Motors cars. In many cases, the airbags failed to deploy. That's the analysis of the Center for Auto Safety, reviewing records in a database, the Fatality Analysis Reporting System, according to the New York Times. In mid-February, GM recalled some 1.3 million cars, none of which are in production anymore, for exactly that problem. After the automaker announced, they had confirmed 31 accidents and 12 deaths. The U.S. Congress has also launched an investigation into a possible cover-up by GM.
And rescuers picked through the rubble, holding out hope to find survivors of the gas explosion in New York City that killed at least 8 people. Meanwhile, investigators are still trying to determine the cause of the gas leak. From New York, Iris Spitzer has more.
At least one person remains unaccounted for after the explosion that flattened 2 buildings in the East Harlem neighborhood just north of Central Park. Standing on the scene, National Transportation and Safety Board investigator Robert Sunwalt said the exact cause of the leak still remains a mystery.
This pipe is still in the ground, so there is no obvious to the eye, no apparent leak location.
Investigators haven't yet reached the basement of the unit where the explosion happened to examine meters and other equipment, which they hope will provide more clues. At least 8 people were killed and over 60 people injured in the blast.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The US and Russia have no common vision on the situation in Ukraine. That's how Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov put it after emergency talks between him and US Secretary of State John Kerry in London today ended without resolve. The 11th hour meeting comes ahead of Sunday's referendum, which will see the Crimean people decide whether the autonomous region should become part of Russia. With the political deadlock between Russia and the West over Ukraine no closer to being broken, much now rests on how Russia reacts to the outcome of Sunday's vote. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead has been following today's crucial meeting in London.
This was seen as the last chance for diplomacy ahead of the weekend's referendum. The polls will open in Crimea on Sunday, but these last-ditch talks in London, which went on for 6 hours, were more about what Russia's next move will be and how the West will react. Both sides couldn't be more apart on the forthcoming referendum.
We, through the words of President Putin, have already said that we will respect the choice of the people of Crimea.
We believe the referendum is contrary to the Constitution of Ukraine, is contrary to international law, is in violation of that law, and we believe it is illegitimate.
Further sanctions against Russia are now on the cards, which could be introduced from the US and Europe from Monday. Secretary Kerry made clear any sanctions will only come from Russia's own actions.
The president has made it clear there will be consequences if Russia does not find a way to change course. And we don't say that as a threat. We say that as a direct consequence of the choices that Russia may or may not choose to make here.
But his Russian counterpart said any measures introduced will not only affect Russia.
U.S. Secretary of State Kerry did not put forward any threats to Russia. As to the possibility of sanctions against Russia, we all live in one information space. We read, we hear, we know what is being discussed in Washington, what is being discussed in Europe. And I would like to assure you that our partners also understand that sanctions are a counterproductive measure.
Before this meeting, Mr. Kerry met with the British Prime Minister David Cameron in Downing Street, who said there must be consequences if Russia and Ukraine do not speak. The British Foreign Secretary William Hague, also in on the meeting, said EU action will be discussed from Monday.
The European Union, including the United Kingdom, will move to further measures, as we have already agreed. If this referendum goes ahead and no diplomatic way forward is found, and we will meet as EU foreign ministers on Monday in Brussels to discuss the next step.
Behind these failed diplomatic talks are divided Ukrainians. Protesting outside today's talks in London, Oksana from Ukraine told me she's not sure what support the West can give her home country.
I think the non-legitimate referendum that is happening on Sunday is probably going to be the turning point. And people in Ukraine, some of them hope that the West will give support and help Ukraine in case of war. But I'm very doubtful of that.
For now, though, all eyes are on Crimea. The result of the referendum on Sunday is expected to show a move for the region to join Russia. For leaders across Europe, this weekend will be spent forming a response to the Kremlin if it pushes ahead with annexing this fought-over region. Dan Whitehead, London.
For more on the ongoing diplomatic deadlock over Crimea and the wider Ukrainian crisis, I spoke to FSN's Natalie Feary in Moscow and Simon Marks here in the US capital. I began by asking Natalie if the threat of Western sanctions had any bearing on President Putin's plans.
We heard the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, say Moscow would respect the result of Sunday's referendum in Crimea on whether to join Russia. So he's certainly not changing his stance. And in fact, in response to these possible sanctions, of course, we don't know how far they'll go. But the deputy prime minister, Dmitry Rogozin, said that the possible economic sanctions would in fact stimulate the Russian economy and industry and would only hurt foreign partners. Now, he seems to be saying that because, of course, Russia is a major trading partner of the EU. It's the third biggest trading partner for the EU, but the EU is Russia's largest trading partner. And almost half of Russia's exports go to the EU. So, of course, the reality is that if these economic and trade sanctions he was talking about were to be imposed, it would have extremely devastating effects on the Russian economy.
Natalie, how has Moscow explained this build-up of Russian troops along the Ukrainian border? And how has it reacted to the recent deadly unrest in the eastern part of the country?
Well, in terms of the build-up of troops along the border, Russia has said that it's part of a military training exercise. Russia's defense minister saying it would go on for 2 weeks. But in terms of the unrest that we've seen, for example, in Donetsk and other parts of East Ukraine, Russia has said that it has the right to protect its compatriots and Russian citizens. And it obviously sees aggression towards Russian citizens and compatriots in those areas. So it does look like it could take moves to try and protect these Russians that are in those areas.
Let's talk a bit about the US role in this. Simon Marks joins me. Simon, Sergei Lavrov said Russia had no plans to invade East Ukraine, despite ominous signs, perhaps to the contrary. But this is a film we've seen before.
It is a film that John Kerry personally has seen before, and I think it's absolutely evident that assurances offered by Sergei Lavrov are frankly not worth very much to the US Secretary of State anymore, which is why he said that while he'd heard what Sergei Lavrov had to say, what he really wants to see is those Russian forces pulling back from the country's border with the east of Ukraine. Lavrov gave assurances 2 weeks ago that the Russians had no territorial ambitions in the Crimean Peninsula. That was evidently not true, and it would seem that the Secretary of State, having been bitten once by the Russian Foreign Minister, doesn't want to be stung a second time.
John Kerry said that Russia could face consequences over its actions in Crimea, but was reluctant to elaborate once again on exactly what form those punitive measures, those sanctions levelled at Moscow, could take. Do we have any detail? And what influence does the US and its allies have over this mess?
Well, look, the referendum is going to take place this Sunday. The outcome of it is clear. Those people who vote in the referendum will vote in favour of joining the Russian Federation. And then the West, the Europeans and the Americans, will engage in ritual condemnation of what has occurred. When we wake up on Monday morning, when we do this programme on Monday evening, I think we're going to be in a radically different world. The US and the European Union are both preparing to unveil a new package of sanctions. We're told that this time round they may sanction more than 100 Russian officials, including some leading members of Vladimir Putin's inner circle, including some captains of industry in Moscow, in a bid to make the West's displeasure more evidently felt in the Russian capital. But if you're Vladimir Putin, you are also aware that there are limits to precisely what the West is willing to do. And it remains to be seen that the equation has changed significantly. It also remains to be seen that the Russians are going to be satisfied simply with annexing the Crimean Peninsula and are not, in fact, going to try and peel parts of eastern Ukraine away.
Simon Marks in Washington and Natalie Feary in the Russian capital. This is FSN Reports. President Obama has announced a review of his deportation policies after weeks of ramped-up pressure from Democrats in Congress and immigrant communities. In Washington, our correspondent Alice Olstein tells us what led the president to take this step and what immigrant rights activists are demanding.
President Obama has ordered the Department of Homeland Security to take an inventory of its immigration enforcement practices and see if it can conduct enforcement more humanely within the confines of the law. The president said he did this out of deep concern about the pain too many families feel from the separation that comes from our broken immigration system. It is not yet known if this review will lead to major changes, or any, to current practices. The announcement came after a meeting late Thursday with three of Congress's most outspoken advocates for immigration reform, who have lately voiced criticisms of the president for continuing to arrest and deport hundreds of thousands of undocumented people who could be covered by future reform proposals. One of them was Illinois Democrat Luis Gutierrez, who took to the floor of the House of Representatives earlier this month to blast President Obama's record on immigration, calling him the deporter-in-chief.
With almost 2 million deported so far, Barack Obama has deported more people than live in the entire state of Nebraska. No one has deported more people. Let's go to boots on the ground. Who spent more money on immigration enforcement than all other federal law enforcement combined? Well, if you guessed Barack Obama, you'd be right. Yes, the $18 billion he spends is $3.5 billion more every year than we spend on the FBI, ATF, DEA, Secret Service, all of them combined. Question four, what crimes are the most prosecuted crimes in federal court? You think kidnapping, murder, counterfeiting, political corruption? No, under Barack Obama, the number one crime prosecuted as a misdemeanor is being illegally in this country, and the number one crime prosecuted as a felony in federal courts is what? Illegal re-entry to the United States? Which of these presidents put more than 420,000 people in detention in just one single year of his presidency? Yes, arrested and put them in jail? President Barack Obama has detained more immigrants in jails, prisons, and detention facilities than any other president of the United States of America.
Gutierrez said he wanted to disprove claims made by his Republican colleagues that President Obama has not done enough to enforce current immigration law. Other congressional Democrats and powerful groups usually aligned with the president, including the AFL-CIO and National Council of La Raza, have joined in criticizing the immigration record and called on the president to use his executive power to grant relief to undocumented communities. Ben Antonio Ginata with Human Rights Watch says the real pressure has come from the grassroots.
This is clearly something that's been driven by the demonstrations on the ground, particularly driven by young immigrants.
Undocumented activists staged two major protests just this week, one at the U.S.-Mexico border, where people deported by the Obama administration demanded to be reunited with their families in the U.S., and another inside a private immigration detention center in Washington state.
Poor medical health care, bad nutritional choices, lack of pay for work. And people were so angry about it that we had 750 people on a long hunger strike to raise awareness about this.
More actions are planned in the coming weeks, including a mass hunger strike and march in Washington, D.C., targeting both the White House and Capitol Hill. Immigrants' rights groups like the National Day Labor Organizing Network say the protests will not stop until they see meaningful actions to stem the tide of deportations. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, it's nearly a week since the Malaysia airliner Flight 370, carrying 239 passengers and crew, disappeared from radar over the Gulf of Thailand. Since Saturday, an international search effort has expanded as new theories build over the whereabouts of the jet. However, authorities and the families of those on board are no closer to an explanation. Now, a Colorado-based company is trying to bolster search efforts through so-called crowdsourcing, placing satellite images of the vast search zone online for people to tag possible sightings of the wreckage. To find out more about crowdsourcing, I spoke to Joe Francica, editor-in-chief of global mapping tech publication Directions magazine.
Crowdsourcing is using anyone and everyone to participate, in this case, in the search for any debris, any wreckage that can be seen with satellite image data over the search area. So it's essentially anyone who has a web browser can access the satellite data via an internet. You don't have to be a trained image interpretation analyst. But if you're interested in participating, you can view online all of these data.
So exactly how is this being integrated into the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370? And have you yourself participated in this search?
Yes, I have participated. I've looked at about 700 plus map tiles through the Digital Globe crowdsourcing platform. I've also started to use the Blackbridge interface as well. That's a different provider of satellite technology. And so, yes, I've participated directly in that.
And how is this information sort of collated and then qualified to be of use to the investigating team leading the search?
So anyone who has tagged a suspected object in the ocean or anywhere does this, as I said, through a web browser interface. And that information is communicated to professional image analysts back at the satellite image companies, whether that's Digital Globe or Blackbridge or any of the other ones that are providing imagery. So there are those that who are doing the crowdsourcing who may not be professional image interpreters. They tag something. That latitude and longitude information is conveyed back to the company. And then there are professional analysts that review whatever object has been tagged, and then it is verified or given some credence.
Has this technology ever been utilized in the past, and do we have anything to compare it to in terms of how successful it is?
Yes, it has been used in Typhoon Haran that hit the Philippines. So this type of crowdsourcing has been used before with success in identifying, areas that were impacted, in particular in the case of the typhoon, damaged structures, for example. So anything that could help rescue workers in that case identify where the impact was greatest felt, it's been very useful.
And Joe, you said you're one of the participants searching these satellite images. Did you come across anything of interest?
I only came across perhaps a ship. It could have been just a fishing trawler looking at seas. I was at one point a professional image analyst, so I've got a little experience in looking at imagery, but primarily, you're looking at inky black sea with a lot of clouds or a white cap. So it's a lot of area to cover, but I guess all eyes, and anyone can help.
Joe Franceca, Editor-in-Chief of Directions magazine. This is FSN Reports. In Britain, an iconic figure of the country's left has died at the age of 88. Anthony Wedgwood Benn was a former cabinet minister and an unstinting campaigner for a variety of left-leaning causes. A lifelong supporter of Britain's campaign for nuclear disarmament, he protested Britain's involvement in the war on Iraq and published a series of diaries that became bestsellers in the UK. He'd been seriously ill for some time, and his death today brought him plaudits from across the political spectrum. FSN's Ollie Barrett reports from our London bureau.
We can begin to achieve socialism in our lifetime. Thank you very much.
Tony Benn never did achieve that goal, but he did reach the status of truly iconic politician, one of the most recognisable faces, but perhaps even more so voices, in the British political establishment.
As a committed Republican and a protest, I take the oath required of me by law under the Parliamentary Oaths Act of 1866 to allow me to represent my constituency.
He became an MP in 1950, serving in the cabinet under Prime Ministers Harold Wilson and James Callaghan. He was born into privilege and married a wealthy American, but rare for a British politician.
turned more to the left as his career at Westminster continued. While he infuriated and angered many political opponents, he was always respected, and Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron is just one right-of-centre figure to have warm words to say about him.
He was an extraordinary man, a great writer, a brilliant speaker, extraordinary in Parliament, and a great life of public and political and parliamentary service. I mean, I disagreed with most of what he said, but he was always engaging and interesting, and you were never bored when reading or listening to him. And the country has lost a great campaigner, a great writer, and someone who I'm sure whose words will be followed keenly for many, many years to come.
In the House of Commons, he was known as a formidable speaker. In 1990, he railed in the chamber in the run-up to the Gulf War.
Now, I will use plain language. I fear that the United States has already decided that when it is ready, it will create a pretext for a war against Iran.
And for many years, a favourite target was Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and Thatcherism. He insisted socialism was not defeated by her.
I go regularly on the trains and I see all the little businessmen with their calculators working out their cash flow, frowning people, looking and glaring at each other. Thatcherite trains, the train of the competitive society. But coming back from Chesterfield the other day, the train broke down. And on the whole exchange, somebody came in and said, I have a cup of tea from my thermos. And then people looked after each other's children. And a young couple talked to me, and I said, after about half an hour, how long have you been married? Oh, we met on the train, they said. And a woman said, will you get off at Derby and ring my son in Swansea, because he'd be worried. By the time we got to London, we were a socialist train. Because you can't change human nature.
Tony Benn and Tony Blair, the former Labour Prime Minister, did not see eye to eye in terms of where they felt the Labour Party should go. Alistair Campbell was Mr Blair's spin doctor.
There were lots of things that he said and did that many, many people in the Labour Party agreed with. Many people in the Labour Party didn't agree with. Many people in the country didn't agree with. But I think that the great thing about living in a genuine democracy, as opposed to some of the other so-called democracies around the world, that Britain is a place where you can have that. And I think that the tributes that were made across the parties to Tony Benn today, they will be sincere.
Tony Benn's latter years were spent campaigning on the issues dear to him, in favour of social justice, against war. In fact, when he stepped down as an MP in 2001, he said it was to spend more time on politics. Ollie Barrett, London.
And so we end this evening with the words of Tony Benn, a message that he left with Britain's Channel 4 News to be played out after his death. Even contemplating his own mortality, the man who famously taped every interview he ever gave in a bid to avoid being misquoted had his eye on accuracy in reporting.
As by definition, I won't be able to say this again. Can I take this opportunity of thanking my family, my mother and father and my two brothers, and above all, Caroline, who inspired me over the 50 years of our marriage, and my children and grandchildren, and all the many, many other people who supported me, encouraged me, and taught me so much. And I hope that in return I encouraged them, and that I didn't give offence, because I tried to speak my mind, and that's what you have to do in politics. So thank you very much. And I'll check that on transmission.
Tony Benn, who died today at the age of 88. And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the show by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there, at Feature Story. Coming up on Monday, all the latest news on the standoff with Russia over Ukraine. It'll be a busy programme. That's Monday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.